Welcome to episode 22 of Techish, featuring Abidesi.
And me, Michael Behane, we're back.
And our very first special guest host.
Yeah.
So yeah. I will let her do introductions.
Hey, I'm Wendy Liu. What should I be saying?
Whatever you want, don't worry.
Sorry.
You put her on the spot, so she's like, what do I say now? It's all good, don't worry.
My background is definitely in the tech industry, but right now I'm not really like a tech worker anymore. I mostly write about tech. From the point of view of almost an outsider. So I've been programming since I was pretty young. I worked like as a software developer for quite a while. I interned at Google when I was in uni, and then I started my own tech company. And that lasted about 3 years before I realized I hated it. I hated everything I was doing, and I was just really, really burnt out and really sick of the world. So I just spent a lot of time reading books, and in the process of doing that, I kind of discovered politics as something that, you know, wasn't just something to participate in passively and like, you know, watch on the news, but something that I could actually like do in my life. And I these days I mostly just like write about tech from like a very political perspective, and I do some political activism as well.
I feel like the first question that popped into my mind, and probably maybe the listeners as well, is why did you hate running your startup? There are so many people that listen to the show that are dreaming of the day they quit their full-time job
and go at it
alone, be their own boss.
Yeah.
What did you not enjoy about that?
Yeah, so I've actually written like a kind of like a longer form retrospective about my startup and why it was so bad. It's called Silicon Inquiry.
Okay, we'll link it.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay, great. But I guess just to summarize it. So the startup was something that I started like right after graduating from uni. And it was kind of like building on research that I had done while at a computer science lab in my undergrad. And it wasn't really like the exact same, but it was like the technology that I'd been working on was something that could really like easily be commercialized. And at the time I was trying to debate between going to work at Google full time or like doing something else. And because I'd interned there the summer before and I just didn't really enjoy working there, I was like, I want to do anything else, anything other than working full time at Google, I will do it. And so this startup opportunity came up with some friends of mine, and we did it. And it was definitely something we dove into without really knowing much about it. Like we had no idea what we were doing is the thing. And we just had this idea that, you know, because we were these like, we were kids, we were full of energy, someone would just like give us money and we would succeed. And like within a year we would have, you know, a ton of revenue, which obviously, you know, that's like a very difficult thing to achieve. We did manage to raise some money, and we did manage to get some customers, but it took over a year before we were able to actually make profit. And we didn't pay ourselves for this time. But I mean, I loved it for a while. We were mostly just trying to figure out what we were building, who we were going to sell to. And so it was initially positioned as this like data science startup. And we were going to like take data from mostly like social media type companies who were, you know, using data from like Facebook and Twitter or whatever. And we were going to help them process it. And then we kind of just like kept pivoting until we found that the easiest way to actually make money in this space was to combine our data on people's social media presence with emails. And so let's say a company like Urban Outfitters can come along and say, we have all these emails, people who've signed up for our newsletter or have shopped on our website, and we want to know how can we best target these people more efficiently. Which of these people likes yoga? Which of these people is like a musician or something?
Yeah.
And we were able to, you know, provide some of that data. And, you know, there's a time when I was like, this is such a cool technical problem, because I was the one building the tech and I really loved it. I really loved just like the challenges of scaling this like really, really complex system. But then after a while, after the technical challenges, like the buzz of that wore off, I was kind of thinking about like what we were actually doing.
Yeah.
And what we were doing was, you know, helping Urban Outfitters sell a few more t-shirts. And at the end of the day, I was like, I'm giving up, you know, like 70, 80 hours a week of my life for this. Like I'm barely doing anything else except this startup. My whole world is a startup. And I looked back on my last few years and I was like, I'm not really proud of what I've achieved. And so it was a little bit, it was this like awakening, this realization that yes, startups can be a great escape from, you know, your day job or something that you hate, but it really only makes sense if it's something you actually want to do. If it's something where you feel like you are making a useful impact on the world, where it's something that's useful for society. And I was thinking about what I had built and the fact that we had so many other competitors who were constantly trying to, you know, to stay ahead of all these other people who are doing the exact same thing as us. Our technology wasn't that special, right?
Yeah.
I was proud of it, but that didn't mean it was useful. It didn't mean that if our technology like just died tomorrow that the world would really care.
Yeah.
And I was thinking like, do I really want this to be something I keep working on? And, you know, I'd already given about 3 years of my life to it. there was a time when I was like, I can't do anymore. This is not worth it.
That's so interesting. I wonder what would it take for you to work full time on a startup again? Like, would it have to be something that has a social impact, like explicitly, or be something quite mission driven? This is quite a leading question because it's one of our new stories this week.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've expanded my idea of what's possible, essentially, because there was a time when I thought of the world in a very individualistic way, right? Like, I thought, you know, the world as it is like mostly fine, and all I have to do is take my place in it, get the best job I can, or start the best company I can. But now I'm starting to see the world as more contingent, more socially constructed, and that there's a lot of potential in trying to actually change the social and political environment of that, as opposed to just functioning within today's political landscape and, like, say, building a company based on what's making a lot of money now, right? Because what I really don't like about the startup world right now is that the incentives are just terrible. Like, if you look at some of the startups that are being funded, right? Venture capitalists are not funding what needs to be solved. And so anyone who tries a startup, if they want to do one that is, like, socially driven, it's going to be hard to get funding. Definitely. It's going to be hard to survive and, like, get... and just be sustainable, because the environment right now is not geared for startups that are producing social value. That is the problem. It's geared towards things like $400 juicers or whatever, right?
Crypto.
And actually, I've got a segment coming up that I want to do where it's based off the YC demo day. And I've basically come up with one fake startup and two real ones. And I want to see which one, if you guys can tell, which one is the fake one.
Oh, man, this sounds great.
We'll come to that later on. So the story essentially is based on an article for a platform that I run called peopleofcolorintech.com. And I interviewed a really smart guy called Marcus Carey. And he's about, you know, he's a mid-30s founder of a cybersecurity startup. And he raised about $3-4 million. So obviously I asked him, I said, so do you have any tips for people that want to raise money? And he said, I'll get the exact quote here. I'll read it verbatim. He says, what I see from people of color, because we were talking mainly about underrepresented founders, and I think our heart is in the right place a lot of times, is that we focus too much on social ventures. I do a lot of mentoring, and we tend to want to be the Martin Luther King of technology or make some big social change. I wish more people focused on building pure tech plays, because I think we could do that. I laugh when people say black Twitter or black this or black that. If we built our own platforms, it would make a significant difference. So I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know, I'm not saying I agree or disagree with any of it, but I want to hear what your take is off the bat, because... cards on the table, both of us have run social ventures or companies with a conscience, whatever term you want to use, right?
Yeah, I think it's like a really valid point to some extent. I don't actually agree with it. There are a lot of people of color working on like big problems within tech. The CEO of like 5AI autonomous car company is an Asian American woman. You're just talking about YC demo day a moment ago, and a lot of the Nigerian companies that were in that cohort are focused on like fintech issues, banking the unbanked, making it easier for companies to find capital. I think the reason why it might feel like people of color founders focus on social issues is just because that's the only time the media talk about the things that we do. So it could be like more of like a asymmetry of information because of like the signaling in the media. Like the stories that capture the headlines and capture the attention are when people of color founders are working on problems that impact their society. And then Elon Musk gets all the headlines about deep tech and other interesting things in
Elon
AI.
Musk.
I don't hate him. I hate it's the right, disproportional amount of media he gets.
No, we both agree with that, to be fair.
Yeah.
Go on.
That said, if you think of the narratives that are perpetuated by successful founders, founders who have had exits, YC School of Thought, Silicon Valley, you're always encouraged to work on the problems that affect you. You're always encouraged to work on the things that keep you up at night. So, you know, the things that keep people of color up at night are things relating to institutionalized oppression, inequities within society. So how can you blame people for, you know, choosing in the very first instance of their entrepreneurship journey to not work on a problem that is so personal and, you know, affects them?
I think the other thing to consider is the... beyond like the media narrative and the fact that the media likes to cover certain stories, it's also the fact that VCs like to fund certain types of startups, right? And so you have like venture capitalists with certain biases who will look at a person of color with, you know, like a deep tech startup, and they'll be like, oh, you don't seem to meet this criteria. Like, I don't believe you're able to do this.
You're not Stanford, bro.
And so, you know, they'll look at a person of color who has a startup that you know, is like deep tech or something, and then they'll just think, oh, this person probably can't pull it off. Mm. I'm just going to give my money to the Stanford bro who is like 19 years old and is just about to drop out of Stanford and has no experience, but you know, fits the profile better.
Yes.
And so yeah, you have bias on both ends, right? The media side and also the actual funding side. And I think what it really comes down to is like people should work on whatever they want to work on, like whatever gets them, drives them, whatever gets them up in the morning. And for some people that will be addressing systemic oppression, for others that will be addressing tech problems. I don't think it's a problem if, you know, people of color decide to work on a plurality of things, right? It's not like there should be like one set path.
Yeah.
Plus the other thing is like, if people of color don't work on these problems,
who's going to work on
them?
You raised two really key things there that I want to talk about, like pattern matching. VCs always talk about pattern matching, and they always talk about that being one of their, you know, skills, one of their superpowers. You know, oh, Sequoia, Andreessen Horowitz, all of these big firms are so good at finding the next Mark Zuckerbergs of the world because they can do pattern matching very effectively. And I think you're right, there is actually a limiting pattern matching process going on in tech world, in Silicon Valley, where we associate underrepresented founders with underrepresented problems. Mm. So maybe VCs feel more confident investing in a Black woman that's building a product that does something for Black women than they would investing in a Black woman that's building a health tech solution with advanced AI. Mm. And then that point around, you know, who will solve these problems? So I was just watching a lecture from a festival called the Do Lectures, which happens in the UK every summer. And it's like the founder of an organization, CEO. Anyway, she quoted this statistic of how 5 people own the same amount of wealth as like 3.5 billion people. And that's gone down from 80 people that held that half of the wealth just 3 years ago, which is terrifying. So there's a real urgency. I'm a bit cynical and like dystopian and stuff, but I always worry that there's going to be some like crazy like class war revolution kind of thing where poor people are just like, enough of this. And that's why all the billionaires are building their like bunkers in the woods or in New Zealand or whatever. And we're on the wrong side of that because we're like too poor to build our own bunkers, but we're also richer than the poorest people. So we're going to be...
Well, we're the ones that will be got... Oh, you work in tech,
exactly.
Yeah?
Exactly.
Okay, we'll get you. Wearing your Google jumper, like... T-shirt.
I think you're right. Like tech people will have to kind of almost choose sides at a certain point. If especially if you want to like forestall the revolution, right? If you want to make things better, like, you know, things are getting worse daily. Mm. And so it's more and more urgent. You know, are tech people going to be like, oh, how do we help rich people stay rich? Or are we going to address the actual like deep economic inequality that's causing so many problems right now?
The latter, for the record, we're working
please,
on the latter.
We're not guys, ladder. Please don't do this.
What are your thoughts, Mike?
Was listening to another vlog that you won, Navarra Media, I think it's called, right? And you threw out the phrase like abolish Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
So you know, I think people always think that me and Abba like are super critical of tech and the valley. So I thought we'd bring somebody else.
To be.
Yeah, we thought Abba, I thought I'd bring somebody else who's like to the left
more
of us.
Critical.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll let you have the mic.
Sure. Okay, so first of all, it's like it's meant as like a deliberately provocative thing. It's like mostly a joke.
Yeah.
I'm not really saying we should, you know, actually abolish Silicon Valley or that it needs to be like nuked or something. It's trying to get people to think about what Silicon Valley actually is in terms of the position that it occupies in the global economy. And specifically the fact that Silicon Valley is this very American phenomenon, right? If you consider the top 5 companies in the world by market cap, right? Like of the top 10, 5 of them are tech. Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, now Alphabet, and Facebook. And these are 5 American companies, right?
Yeah.
And there's something interesting about that. And if you start to ask yourself why that is, and you look at the history and you look at the U.S. military industrial complex, you look at the position that the U.S. has held in the world economy for, I mean, especially in the last 30 years, but even before that, right after the war with Bretton Woods, and the role that the U.S. has played in underpinning just like global capital flows. And you ask yourself, why is Silicon Valley so outsized today? Why is there so much venture capital money coming from the U.S.?
Yeah.
What does that mean for the rest of us? I mean, that's pretty important. And so when I talk about abolishing Silicon Valley, it's about reshaping the economy and fundamentally transforming it so that the current imbalance of power and wealth that we see does not occur anymore. And that's like, that's a huge, huge undertaking, right? Because the way I see Silicon Valley is that it's kind of like an outgrowth of the rest of the economy and specifically the trends that have been occurring for the last 40 years in particular, where you're seeing this agglomeration of wealth and you're seeing technological development being centered around this very, very small area on the West Coast of the US.
Yeah.
And like that's a problem. That's not something that we should just accept as natural. That is the result of a bunch of different historical factors and political decisions. And there are open questions around whether that is sustainable or whether that's the best model going forward. And as we've just talked about just now, one of the major problems with Silicon Valley is the way that so much wealth and energy and time is being focused on really, really like not important problems, right? Like laundry. Yeah. You know, you have 10,000 different apps around food delivery or like laundry and whatever. And it's like
Uber for X.
Yeah. And then the question is like, should all these people be working on these things, or are they working on these problems because of just this really like flawed incentive structure, which itself needs to be reformed? Because another thing that I'm trying to say when I talk about abolishing Silicon Valley as a structure is that we shouldn't really blame individual founders necessarily.
Of course.
Right. Because it's not necessarily their fault. Right. Like people are just doing the rational thing in a world that values, trying to raise money from VCs and and do silly startups that you can nevertheless raise $50 million for.
Yeah. They're just following the incentives, essentially. Yeah. That's there.
Exactly. And so I think the logical question to ask is, how do we change the incentive structure? How do we actually create deeper transformations so that the problems that we see today no longer arise in like now and in the future?
I've just come back from Silicon Valley. I literally
just got back
the other day. It was a really great trip. I mean, I work for a product and an angelist, and I was out there running some like hustle crew workshops on inclusion. But that was really interesting for me because it's a very homogenous place. You know, the types of people you interact with, the types of people making big decisions, the types of people who hold the greatest power and influence are still, for the most part, heterosexual white men. If you think of the world at large and the roles that, on average, heterosexual white men play, They're facing, you know, the lesser amount of social issues and like the lesser amount of, you know, oppression and struggle and all that sort of thing. So what does that mean for the most vulnerable people in the world? The people who desperately need innovation and technology when the people who hold the power to change things are so far removed from them and don't really relate to them?
Down to network effects, in the sense that there's been so much effort that's gone into building Silicon Valleys in other areas, but I feel like people are in Silicon Valley because everybody else is in Silicon Valley. All the investors are there, so all the entrepreneurs are there, and all the entrepreneurs are there, so all the investors are there. And it's a big problem. I mean, if you think about it, in every city and town, I remember reading this, how there probably was like a taxi operator that was probably a millionaire in his local area, and now Uber's come in and wipe that guy out. Okay, let's not feel sorry for a millionaire, right? But, you know, at least the wealth was local. And now it's been sucked up by that platform, and that platform is all the way based in Silicon Valley. So it's like, I think the problem is almost insurmountable. I hate to sound like a pessimist. Do you have any solutions? on the spot.
Yeah, I'll solve it all right now. Yeah. I just want to say I agree with everything that's been said so far. You can't hear it on the podcast, but I've been like nodding the whole time. Great. Love this analysis. And so what? Back to what you're saying about like Uber, for example, right? Like, I totally agree with that analysis. The way it's taking money that traditionally would have gone to labor in a very localized way, and sucking it up back to Silicon Valley. And I think when looking at that sort of problem, you have to recognize the fact that it's not like a unilateral thing. There are good things about these platforms. There are bad things. There are all these different trends and tendencies in different directions.
Yeah.
And one of the things these companies have been really good at is like conflating them all and like bundling them. And so if you look at what Uber's been doing, Uber has done some great things. Like there are some really cool innovations in the platform.
Right.
And that can cause efficiency gains for drivers, for consumers. And that's great. On the other hand, there are some really terrible things that are bundled into that. Right.
Yeah.
And if you look at, there have been a bunch of suicides of Uber drivers in New York recently. And just like the way some drivers are like, they feel like they're constantly forced to overwork.
They're on minimum wage, essentially, aren't they? Let's keep it real. It's a minimum wage job.
Yeah, I mean, depends on the area. I've heard stories about Uber in Ghana and just like behaving super rapaciously, using debt to try to get the drivers into debt bondage. These are things that aren't really talked about, for one, because like, you know, the tech press doesn't really care about what's happening. It's always presented as a story about innovation. Yeah, if you look at what's actually happening behind the scenes of a lot of these tech companies, they use innovation as this like shield to deflect responsibility from, you know, taking care of the people that they say they're giving opportunities.
Right.
So Uber and Deliveroo here, they don't like the idea of their drivers or riders being considered workers because then they'd have to provide them more protection and more benefits.
Yeah.
Instead, they're like, oh, we just give them opportunities. But at the same time, they're giving them opportunities while making a lot of money off their work.
And of course.
I think another way of looking at this in terms of historical context is if you look at the Keynesian golden ages, right, like say 1945 to the mid-70s, you had a very different social and political landscape. And back then, companies were... They followed like a completely different paradigm where it was more expected that they would provide benefits and secure wages and everything.
Mm.
And I'm not saying we should go back to that, but there are good and bad elements of that. For one, the fact that like women were not really supposed to be working. But at the same time, what we've been seeing the last 40 years under this very neoliberal paradigm is that corporations are more and more willing to continue to make money off their workers' work while treating them not as workers, right?
Right.
While trying to abdicate as much responsibility as possible. And so in the case of Uber and Deliveroo, it's like it's very, very clear with what they're doing, right? They want to be able to control the people who are working for them, who are actually responsible for the wealth that they're accumulating, but they don't want to be able to have to take care of them.
Oh, yeah.
They want the state or like whoever.
For anything that happens to them.
Exactly. And yeah, I think what we have to do is like fundamentally we need to see this as what it is, and that this is not necessarily the only way. That the way tech companies function right now is just the product of a bunch of different economic factors, and that the technology that they so far have been hoarding, in a sense, like that they've kind of locked up within these corporate structures, that technology does not have to be deployed the way it is now.
Yes.
It's deployed in the current way because of just like the prevailing, political landscape, and there are ways of changing that. But I mean, that this is something where I think you need to innovate on multiple fronts, right? So you need to innovate on the technical front. You need people who are creating like great new technology, but you also need to innovate on the social front and like just changing the landscape. And, you know, that could mean like electoral politics, that could mean political movements, other sorts of campaigning, creating other institutions, whatever. But they're just like, you have to change more than just like the actual technology because that is only deployed in like a particular landscape, essentially.
Something that was mentioned in that lecture I talked about, by the way, her name is Vicky Saunders, the founder of
CEO. We'll put it in the show notes.
She mentioned this crazy idea of like winner takes all, right? Mm. We are obsessed with winner takes all. If you try to create another network of vehicles, network of car, any kind of transportation network right now, VCs are going to laugh you out the room because they're going to be like, what, you're going to take on Uber? They just raised another round valuing them at $72 billion.
Right,
yeah. People are going to be like, haha, whatever. And why do we accept that startups, especially in specific categories with like low unit economics, can optimize for winner takes all, aim for winner takes all, whilst at the very same time talking about monopolization and the prevention of monopolies through legislation, like, you know, certain mergers between media companies are heavily investigated and then potentially blocked because once a company has a monopoly on a market share, they can control the industry. They can like put all that power into like a negative way onto either their workers or their customers or whatever. So I do sometimes wonder about this weird disconnect and like and the contradictions, because where is like the monopoly theory for tech? It's somehow tech because it's growing so quickly and governments are struggling to catch up, and also governments are really still reeling from like the economic crisis of 10 years ago. It's like tech companies are allowed to have monopolies, and that's fine. And if anything, they're encouraged by their investors to gain them.
Of course, yeah.
What's
thing
that
is,
about?
Most of us don't take time to read what these people are saying. So I read Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One.
Yeah,
and
he talks
about your goal is to create a monopoly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're not creating a monopoly, it's not worth your time.
Yeah.
Essentially, right? You don't want to be the 100th restaurant, you know, selling Thai food or whatever, right? You want to be the one search engine. So we have a system now that's set up to create a monopoly, even though monopolies are technically illegal. So once you get to that monopoly stage, you spend all your time saying, we're not a monopoly, don't think. So he says that Google will say, for example, that they are, you know, a search business. They won't say that we're an advertising company, because when you look at it, they dominate online. Now Facebook has come in, but essentially those two companies have, I don't know, 80% share of the online ad market, which is encroaching to me. That's encroaching on almost monopolistic territory.
80% of all internet searches, probably more now, occur on Google. How's that not a monopoly of information?
Exactly, right? I mean, shout out to Bing. So they, you know, Kara Swisher, she runs a podcast called Recode and whatever. She asked Mark Zuckerberg, like, who are your competitors? And he started stuttering. He couldn't think. He actually couldn't do it.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it. Of course he can't do it. Like, there is no competitor. Maybe you could say Snapchat, but it's almost laughable.
Bebo.
High five, Bebo, MySpace. Rest in peace, guys. There's been a rather public spat between Bernie Sanders, the politician, the Vermont senator from the States, who was a Democratic, you know,
he ran on an independent ticket, I think, right?
No, he ran... Yeah, he caucuses with the Democrats. I don't even know what that means. I always hear them say that, right? But he caucuses with Democrats.
He tried to get the Democratic nomination, right. But he lost to Hillary Clinton.
There we go. So, yeah, he's had a rather public spat with Amazon. So Jeff Bezos, because like Bernie's been, you know, going hard and just saying, listen, these companies are not paying their staff and we're subsidizing them with Medicare and all the aforementioned government programs. So... that's not out of the ordinary. He normally does that. But what actually surprised me was that Jeff Bezos came out and was like, I made a statement saying these are all like mistruths and we've invited him to our warehouse to see like the standard of condition. God. And Bernie's come back out now and said, listen, I'm going to introduce legislation to target these companies. So is Bernie on the right track?
So if you look at the potential avenues for change, right? One is maybe on the consumer front. You know, us as consumers, we could all decide to boycott Amazon. But the thing is, because Amazon is so efficient, because of these network effects and just like the amount of wealth and power it has in coordinating this like huge logistics network, Amazon is going to be the better option for both of us. And I think it's impractical to insist on people to try to behave ethically when, you know, it's just like not that convenient for everyone. And some people just like... there aren't any other options a lot of the time than using Amazon. And so then in that case, the only avenue for change that appears more promising is legislative, right? Or like some sort of political action to ensure that Amazon, this company that has like created some wonderful technological innovations, adheres to standards that we as a society have decided upon in terms of labor law, in terms of, you know, whatever it is that we're unhappy about. And I do think it's really important to remember just that the labor side of Amazon is a story that's only come out in the last couple of years that people have started talking about, right? Like, I mean, this has been happening for a long time, right? Yeah. It's not like Amazon, you know, only just like started hiring warehouse workers. It's just that these stories just haven't really come out, and Amazon has done a really good job of like concealing it and acting as if its wealth just like kind of appeared out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we ship things to everybody using like robots, right? Like,
right.
They want people to think that. They don't want people to think about the dark human costs of what's actually happening. And I think as these stories come out, the important thing to remember is that it doesn't really make a difference if, you know, a few of us decide to boycott Amazon because we can, because we have better alternatives. What we should be pushing for is taking advantage of the technological innovations in a way that still respects, you know, the workers' like basic human rights.
Yes.
And maybe that means like pushing for legislation. Maybe that means encouraging trade union membership among these workers and figuring out how to set up institutions and support like different political actions.
Really interesting story that broke last week, actually, was Glassdoor. We all know Glassdoor, the recruitment site. Published a list of 15 different companies that do not require job applicants to have college degrees. And it was surprising from the tech angle because some really well-known tech firms were on that list, including Apple, Google, and IBM. So we've spoken in the past about, I guess, barriers to entry for building tech careers and particularly within like notable tech firms. So I wanted to get your view on this. How does that make you feel knowing that these companies have removed that from their job applications? Do you think more companies should do it?
Definitely. I think it's a small step in the right direction. So ironic because Facebook and Apple were founded by college dropouts. So for them to then create an institution wouldn't hire them, essentially, it's kind of crazy. I think last episode we talked about how the ageism in tech and how, like, if you're a young founder, actually, you probably get more respect than a young employee. So there's certain things where it's like the person who starts the company probably couldn't even exist within their structure. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, small step in the right direction. But, you know, many a ways to go. Because I want to know what are the requirements for somebody who hasn't got a college degree to join these companies. Because I hope it's not a situation where it's like, you have to have done a million side projects and your GitHub repo has to be completely...
Oh, I mean, it definitely is.
And hackathons. I mean, and there's a problem with that in itself because I never, like, did. I never used to like hackathons because I was like, why am I working 24 hours here? Like, what if you're a single mother with a kid? Like, you don't have time for that.
Yeah.
But what if you have the attitude to actually work at those companies and you just never got the shot? Yeah. But yeah, like I said, that's why I said it's a small step in the right direction and not necessarily a panacea for everything.
I think something that I always talk about in like Hustle Crew meetups and in my book is that one of the things that fails, that university and schools fail to teach us is understanding the perspective of the hiring manager. Mm. A university degree doesn't tell you anything more than you're disciplined enough to get complete that degree. It doesn't tell me that you have evidence to prove you'll be competent in the role I'm hiring for, right? That's where the examples come in. Mm. So I think in the absence of university degrees, if you are going for a software engineering role or like a research scientist role or whatever, you're going to have a hell of a lot of examples, either of your transferable skills or directly relatable work experience to demonstrate to that hiring manager that you'll be competent in the role.
But what's come in terms of a replacement for college degrees are like extortionate boot camps. Yeah. So there's a lot of people that are now paying like 10 Gs, 20 Gs for these boot camps. And that's even more exclusionary.
What was the one that you saw the other day?
Which one?
Like boot camp for rich kids.
Oh, no. So there's parents sending their little kids essentially to coding boot camps at like the age of like 10. And it's like $1,000 a week. Crazy. Wow. But this is obviously, I'm talking at a later stage where people are trying to make a career transition. And that's obviously limiting to people that don't have access to that kind of wealth offhand.
Yeah.
There are a few boot camps that are like free entry and then you pay a percentage of your income, which is probably a fair way of doing things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm still concerned.
One thing to remember is that there's the official list of like requirements that a company will put out, and then there's the unofficial one. And of course, that'll differ depending on like who the hiring managers are, who the interviewers are. And even though all these companies have to say by law that they do not discriminate based on race, gender, immigration status, whatever, of course they do, right? Mm. Of course they do, because the people who are hiring do. And so you'll have a case where, you know, like a white guy who doesn't have a college degree, but who still has like a GitHub profile, a Hacker News account or something, is going to have a much easier time getting a job than, say, like a woman of color who doesn't have a college degree. Agreed. And doesn't have those things. Mm. And so, yeah, it's like, it's great that these companies are willing to consider those without college degrees, but how much added pressure are they putting, like you were saying, on other things, like having a GitHub profile, having gone to hackathons all the time? Not everyone can do that. Like a lot of white men, especially who are in the tech industry, like to say that it's a level playing field, it's a meritocracy, because anyone can just learn to code. Mm-hmm. Anyone can like, you know, push side projects on GitHub. No, they can't if they have to actually, you know, work. If their day job does not let them do that.
Or they've had dependents, like kids or parents to look after or whatever.
Exactly. And so like the way this discussion is framed a lot of the time is just like, it's very, it's not considering like questions of privilege. It's not considering how the playing field is not actually level, right? And like almost every single case. And going back to the interview thing, I think like a really useful way of viewing the interview, especially for software engineering, but for like any company really, is like as a site of like struggle. It's like a war, right? Mm. Almost like a class war, where it's like you versus the interviewer. You have to figure out how to convince them that you are good at the job and should be hired. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to really like prove to you that you're not, and you know, get you to lower your salary, right? And I think for people, especially who are like coding bootcamp graduates and who don't fit the traditional role, they have a much harder time, and they have to treat it as such. They have to treat it as like, not that they need to like meet the interviewer's requirements, that they just need to make the interviewer think that they meet the requirements. And like I think it's like a mistake to think of companies as these like benevolent creatures who will just reward those who work hard, right? They're the people who run these corporations, and like the people who are making decisions within these corporations, they're just trying to optimize for their company, right? They're trying to get the lowest like salaries they can from the people who aren't like, you know, negotiating for better salaries. That is why a lot of people of color especially tend to get like lower starting salaries.
Oh yeah.
Because like they haven't been taught to negotiate, and maybe the hiring manager doesn't like when they negotiate. They're like, oh, you're too pushy.
Yeah.
And so they end up just being like, no, we just won't hire you, right? Yeah, and in that case, it's like, if you treat it as like a conflict, then that's like a much more fruitful way of viewing it. And then you also see that corporations have a habit of, I guess, like dividing the people who they're considering hiring, potential applicants, based on things like race, based on things like gender, in such a way that if they can get away with like paying women less, they will, right?
Yeah.
They will. And it's not necessarily like this, like this evil, like masterminded plot. It's just like this is like structurally what's encouraged. And we've seen in the last few years the rise of these contractor workforces. I don't know if you guys have like talked about this before, but Bloomberg released an article a couple of weeks ago about how at Google there are actually now more contract workers than full-time employees.
Oh, wow.
And contract workers, I mean, that this is like very, very recent, and no one's really talking about this in the Valley. But that includes people who are like bus drivers, people who are cafeteria workers, cleaners, but also contract coders. And a lot of the times, like if you look at the diversity stats between like contract coders and full-time coders, contract coders are much more likely to be women, people of color, people from non-traditional backgrounds.
And they don't get benefits.
They don't get benefits. They don't get stock. They don't get, a lot of the time, they don't even get good healthcare. And they're mostly employed by these like shell companies, really, who, because they're like a different, they're not Google, the company. Google doesn't really have responsibility. If these people don't have a good time, if they don't like their managers, they can't complain to Google. They have to complain to their shell company, essentially. And the shell company most of the time is like, we just don't care. And I've talked to some people who are contractors at places like Google and Facebook who are just really unhappy with their situation. But they feel like they can't complain because for them, you know, they don't have a traditional coding background. Maybe they're an underrepresented minority. They feel like this is the best they could get. And that's like, that's something that is actually true, maybe. Like, and that's really sad.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be this way, right? Like, these companies make so much money. They could afford to pay their workers more. They could afford to, like, pay all their staff more.
Yeah.
Right? But instead, they create the system of, like, segregation based on occupation, based on background, because they can, because it helps them save costs. Whenever they post their quarterly earning reports, it helps when they say, oh, we only have, like, this many full-time employees.
Yeah.
Because then investors are like, oh, yeah, that's great.
All of the black men and women that I know that work full time at Google are contractors. Some of them are in their second year, but they're just being renewed and renewed and renewed. And apparently it's very difficult to convert from a contractor into actual like full time employee position. And it just feels shady. It feels so shady.
What's brought about this change? Why have they decided to embark on this
cost
now?
Cost driving. Yeah. So I actually wrote an article about this, which I can like link you guys to
send
later.
It to us. Yeah.
But this is something, it's been happening for a while now. I remember, so when I was interning at Google, they did have this contractor system. It was very small. And no one really talked about it and it wasn't as bad. It's like gone huge over the last few years. And yeah, now they're like, I think 120,000 contractors compared to like less than 100,000 full-time employees at Google.
I mean,
similar stats at other companies. The company likes to dangle the possibility of converting as a way to get them to work harder.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you just like push, you know, work overtime unpaid for the next 6 months, then maybe we'll consider converting you. And for a lot of these companies, they don't have a good conversion process. Like I've heard stories about Facebook just like not actually having a process in place to make it easy for someone to convert. And so it's like a huge pain in the ass and they have to like post a new job listing. Right? They will say, you know, you fail the coding interview, we can't hire you full time, but we can offer you a position as a contractor, and maybe in 6 months we'll reevaluate and see.
So it's like a two-tier, like almost track for employment.
Yeah, that's crazy. If you consider like the racial, you know, bias elements there, and it's like it's
YC demo day for summer 18 startups.
Yes,
Wendy's excited.
Forward to this.
Let's see if you guys can get this. So I have wrote down a few startups that successfully pitched on demo day, and I've created one fake one. So it's three in total, and I want to see if you guys can guess which is a fake startup and which are the real startups.
Okay.
So the first startup is called DroneSafe. It's a drone-based delivery of medication if you need immediate medication. The next startup is called IWasPoisoned.com. Through its website, the company allows for user-generated reports of food poisoning to detect outbreaks in real time. The next startup, Granddad's On Demand, essentially. To solve the problem of loneliness, Papa, it's the name of the app, Papa, connects college students with senior citizen homes. College students are matched with seniors to help them with tasks related to transportation and tech. So which is it? It's either DroneSafe, IWasPoisoned.com, or Papa, which is Granddad's On Demand, which is the real startup, which is the fake startup.
Oh my God, this is hard. So there's one fake startup.
There's one fake startup.
Two are real.
Okay. Two are real, one is fake.
Okay. I'm going to guess IWasPoisoned.com is fake, just because I can't see that being a YC startup, unless they're like, because I'm trying to figure out what the revenue model could be, right? And it's like, unless they're trying to sell it to the CDC or something. That's like,
what's CDC?
Center for Disease Control in the US.
Oh, right, okay.
I'm trying to keep my poker face so you guys can't tell. Abba, what do you think is the fake startup?
They all kind of, I even feel like the third one doesn't sound like very YC-ish.
Granddad on Demand.
I don't see what the like.
That's too, yeah.
I don't feel like.
So it's not Granddad on Demand, sorry, it's Grandkids on Demand. So if you're an old person and you need someone to come help you, it's Grandkids on Demand.
I just don't know what like so the defensible tech is there. It's just like a matchmaking system.
I mean, you've got, you know, youthful people at universities that need extra cash. And
right.
You can be a
grandkid. Wait, who's paying for that?
So I guess the old people the home that they're in.
That's pretty sinister. If you think about it, that's just like, instead of having, like, you know, the state ensure that people who are retired are able to, like, live in dignity.
Mm.
It's like, you know, this is very, like, neoliberal, like, Uber for,
yeah.
Uber for retirement.
Longevity. Yeah, Uber for family.
Oh, dear, that's awful.
Right, but we're going to need an answer
okay.
now.
Okay. My fake one is... I also, sorry, but like the drones thing as well, it's like they must be partnering with pharmacies because you can't dispense medicine as a drone company.
They are.
Okay. I'm going to go with granddad, papa, whatever.
And you're both wrong.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
The drone safe one, I made it up completely.
No.
Yeah, so papa's slogan, the grandkids on demand one is real. And the IWasPoisoned.com is also real.
What?
this is a great game. Wow. I like
so,
this.
So, but I just want to throw out there. Shout out to all the founders doing their thing. It's not easy to do a startup, but we're obviously just joking. But yeah, it's quite an interesting way of seeing like how amusing some of these startup ideas are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun little segment.
Yeah, nice. I mean, fair enough. Like my startup, if you described it, it sounds really stupid. And so it's like, you know...
And the funny thing is, like, a lot of, like, Silicon Valley ethos is, like, if it sounds crazy, then it's actually a better idea. Because if it sounds obvious, then everybody will do it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Airbnb, oh, like, strangers will sleep on your sofa. Like, who the hell wants to do that?
That's not later, the tagline, like, they went with.
Birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Can't believe he's been dead for 10 years. 2008, man. I still remember where I was when I found out that he died. I was on a bus somewhere and somebody was like, yo, he had a heart attack. I was like, what? Then I came home and me and my mum were just watching it in the news and we just couldn't believe it, man. But yeah, so 60th for MJ. Funny story, actually, like, so related to this. So Sony, his record label, were being sued in regards to, I think the Jackson family was suing them because it turned out that they were using fake vocals on one of his post-death albums. Yeah, so there was an album called Michael that came out a couple years after he died. And like about three tracks they used an impersonator and they have admitted.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it's crazy. What? Like, yeah. Do you have a favorite MJ story, Abadesi? Were you a big MJ fan or were you more Prince person?
I love MJ. Oh, are they substitutes?
I think a lot of people are more like, I'm a Prince person versus I'm an MJ person.
I love them both.
Equally?
I listened to Michael Jackson more growing up.
There we go.
For sure. I remember like staying up with my brother to watch the premiere of one of his music videos.
Black or white?
When did that come out?
93?
Yeah. Because it was like such a big deal. I think it like premiered like on TV.
Yeah.
On a Friday night or something, like, you know, during like the normal sitcoms and like comedies. So I remember my brother and I were like waiting there. This is like back when like TVs were like super large. And I think we even like tried to tape it on our VCR or something. But I remember we were like so excited. He was like the biggest pop star that I knew of when I was like a kid.
Mm.
And I also knew the Jackson 5. And, you know, going back to this idea of like representation and stuff like that, you know, he really meant a lot for black culture, even though obviously he looked white.
He represented all the races.
But
he transitioned.
But there weren't really that many like superstars from black culture. Like there were athletes.
Not
and
on
stuff
that level.
Like that. Not
on that
level.
Level. Yeah.
Like, he was so famous.
You could go to any village in the world and be like Michael Jackson, and they'd be like, somebody would know.
Exactly.
Like I'm talking the most remote place, like in Timbuktu, and people would know who like MJ was, kind of thing.
And then I moved to East Africa when I was a kid. I was there to Tanzania and Kenya, and I remember one of his videos debuted on TV as well. And I remember it was the song that he did with his sister.
Oh, Scream.
Yes, and Busta Rhymes. And it was the
Busta Rhymes is in it.
He does a cameo.
Does he do a cameo?
Did I make that up?
Maybe you made that up. Maybe. Who knows? We'll fetch that later.
Yeah, no, he's not in that. maybe this is the one that I stayed up to watch because this came out in 1995.
Is it a Janet song, maybe?
No, Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, Scream. I'm just on the internet now looking it up.
It's like a white video and they're in space.
When it came out, it was the most expensive music video in the world. Okay, this came out May 1995. Okay, that is the video that I remember. That would make more sense because I don't think I remember anything from 1993. But I remember when that came out, I was like, oh my gosh. And then there was that double CD. Like, this was on an album, which was
history.
A double CD, History. I don't know, listen. And I used to
I know all this MJ
sneak
trivia.
Into my older sister's room and like listen to the CD when she wasn't there. And I used to be really like a real environmentalist when I was a kid, like okay. probably more so than I am now. Like I was like Lisa Simpson trying to channel my inner hippie. And I remember my favorite song in this album was Earth Song.
That was a banger.
Right? And I was like...
Bro, I'm not going to do the vocals anymore, but I want to...
But no, seriously. That was amazing. And I remember... And the CD had the lyrics in the book.
Yeah.
And I would listen to Earth Song and I was like, man, like, why don't Save we just the world, listen man. To Michael, yeah. man? Let's listen to this guy. So yeah, that's my Michael story. How about you?
Rest in peace. I got too many, man. I just remember like dancing to like... MJ's music and do impersonating him when I was like 8 years old. And one time I got too excited and I bit my tongue and I was like, because you know when you got to get into it, you got to do, you know, the faces and everything. I just bit my tongue and I just like I had to go to the A&E and everything. They were like, yo, I still got the lump on my tongue to this day.
Oh my god.
But yeah, no, rest in peace, MJ. We miss you. Okay, so Serena Katsuk thing I want to talk about quickly. Like, so the French Open. Are trying to ban her from wearing almost like this Wakanda inspired catsuit that she wore last time round. Yeah, they have banned her, right? They came out and said, yo, next year you're not doing it, basically. And in fact, the irony is that she wore it for health reasons. It was basically...
She had blood clots.
Right, yeah, she has a propensity to have blood clots and it helps her. But it just... I don't know why any of us are surprised. Tennis has always been an elitist sport.
Racist,
and yeah,
patriarchal.
Yeah, all of the above. And
it's like,
you know,
French people have like... way higher license for racism. No, but do you not sense that? Like, no shade. Like,
to all our French listeners.
I know that not every
of course,
French
yeah,
person
yeah.
is racist, etc. But I have friends that live in Paris. You know, being in London, it's not that hard to get to. There's almost like an accepted level of Islamophobia in that society, unfortunately, because of all the terror attacks that have happened. But there's also almost like an accepted level of like racism as
100%,
well,
like yeah.
anti-blackness. It was highlighted when that Malian refugee
we climbed the walls and
scaled the wall
and then they gave him citizenship. Yeah,
and people were like, oh, so you gotta like risk your life to get citizenship. So I don't know, like you said, like I'm not surprised. Misogynoir, which we covered in a previous episode, is alive and well. Like, it's black women do just get extra shade, extra hate. What I love, though, is Serena was just like, okay, I can't wear a catsuit. Watch me in my tutu. Like, came out in this, like, badass dress, which was amazing. Someone on Twitter pulled out an image from, like, a French Open, like, 15, 20 years ago with, like, a white woman in a white
Yeah. I read up on it, though. I think she got banned as well, though, to be fair. But, like, yeah, you're right. It's such an elitist sport. And, you know, what you're saying about the French... They don't get that much flack, actually, for what their government does in Africa, to be honest. Like, we're always like, oh, you know, the US and Britain, like, colonial, neocolonialism. But France is in there, man. They're still, like, they wield such amount of control over the Francophone countries in Africa.
Also, like, this idea of, you know, inclusion being important, it's not just about tech, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
It's in these international sports bodies as well. They're corrupt AF, as we noticed with the Sepp Blatter saga in the world of football slash soccer. Now you have a bunch of like, you know, power crazy, middle-aged, heterosexual, affluent white guys getting their knickers in a twist over someone's costume. Like,
yeah, it's nuts.
They're bigger fish to fry in the world of tennis, surely. If we had women in there, or other people.
But to be honest, a lot of the racism that Serena has faced in tennis has come from other women. There was one player who mimicked her physique by like stuffing stuff under her bra and like under her skirt to make it out as if like, oh, look at my big bum. Like, so I think there has to be real inclusion in whoever the governing bodies are in tennis, not just necessarily along the lines of gender, but also along the lines of intersectionality. Black women is what I'm saying.
Yes, keep shining, Serena.
I've seen one of the films and Abba seen the other. So,
color in Hollywood.
So go ahead, Abba, you talk about your film.
So I watched Crazy Rich Asians when I was in New York. Best rom-com ever. I went with my cousin, Aura. Shout out, Aura. So, you know, we're from the Philippines. Don't really get to see that many films with all Asian cast. This is actually the first Hollywood film in 25 years, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was the last one, to have an all Asian cast. And it was just incredible. For those of you who don't know, the storyline is simple. You have a main character, she meets her boyfriend, and then basically travels to Singapore for a wedding where he's the best man and discovers that he comes from a very affluent society that holds really high status in society. And she's trying to like come to terms with that, fight off, you know, the other love interests and all this kind of stuff. But what I enjoyed most about the movie was how it showed like Asian family life and how we interact with one another, the kind of jokes that we make, the aunties and the uncles. It was amazing. It was really good. I laughed, I cried, I laughed again. I'm going to watch it again.
I got to watch it. Is it out in the UK? I haven't seen any like...
Maybe it has out.
I don't think it's dropped here yet. New York. I'll check it out.
But yeah, it was amazing. If you haven't seen it yet, go see it.
What did you make though? There were some people that were basically dissing the character played by Awkwafina. Basically the girl that was doing the black scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Some people were like, yo, like, what are you doing kind of thing? Because she doesn't talk like that in real life.
Interesting. So she's a rapper.
She's a rapper, right? Yeah.
For people who don't know. I'd never... came across her until this film. She was hilarious. She's hilarious. And I have since listened to her music. There are people like her, so I feel like it was representative.
As in, there are people from the States that are Asian that might speak in that manner, basically.
Yeah, I think there are people that like, and you know, I see people from Nigeria who are like this as well. They like go to university.
Nigerians are the worst. What's up, May?
You know
what's
up? And then suddenly they're like, yeah, US gangsters. Yeah. And you're like, oh, what's happening there? Like, you know, they they fully adopt that like urban American swagger. So I feel that like she was represented that. We all know someone like that.
Okay, cool. I ain't seen it, so I'll withhold judgment. So the film I wanted to quickly review is Black Klansman. So that's a Spike Lee film that is based on a true story of a black police officer who infiltrates the KKK and even gets to speak to like David Duke, who was the Grand Wizard of the KKK back in the 70s.
This is amazing.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And, you know, Spike Lee's films, I find them to be quite hit and miss. This one's actually quite good as a like piece of entertainment. But there are things that I did kind of nitpick in it. There are certain scenes where it feels like he's making an equivalency between black power and white power. And what I mean by that is it's a scene where you have a scene of KKK people saying white power, white power, white power. And then you have an equivalent scene of like almost Black Panther-esque people saying black power, black power, black power. And in interviews, he said, oh, I'm not saying there's an equivalency because obviously we know one is rooted in fighting back against oppression and one is, can we oppress you, please? So he's acknowledged that. But when I watched the film, I can imagine somebody with a simplistic mindset watching that film and thinking, yeah, both of those are really bad. And what we should have is just, you know, like, everybody should just be nice to each other. And the other criticism that people have said is that it kind of, it's almost pro-police propaganda in the sense that the police are kind of the hero in the sense that there is racism within the police force that you see in the film, but it's kind of squashed at the end as if like we fixed it all. So I can see why people would say that. But all in all, I enjoyed it as a film. I thought it was his best film for years. And I know some people are saying, oh, like, I'm sick of, like, black trauma being, you know, put in as a vehicle for entertainment. And I get that perspective completely. But I couldn't help but not enjoy the film. It's, like, a really funny and entertaining film, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But make up your own minds. Check it out, Black Klansman.
One of the things I want to touch on is, like, the actor is the son of Denzel Washington, right?
Yeah.
And there was that amazing clip where a journalist is talking to him and he's like, oh, you know, growing up in a dynasty, your father's Denzel Washington. And he like cuts him off and he's like, my mother was famous before Denzel. She was in, you know, plays, she was in films, she was the breadwinner. And I was just like, oh my God, like what a way to champion.
You know what though? Like I saw that and I had that perspective as well, but I also had the other perspective because I've been aware of him for quite a while and he kind of really hates it when people bring up his dad. As in like, if you're somebody who's trying to strive in the industry and everyone's always like, oh, your dad, you're Denzel's son, you're Denzel's son, you're Denzel's son, you're trying to be an actor.
It's like, I'm my own person.
I'm my own person. So I think as much as that was rooted in him uplifting his mum, it was also kind of him like,
Shut up, man.
Like, yeah. But like, yeah, don't get twisted. It was a beautiful thing to say because obviously he's right. His mumsy was accomplished, you know, in her own right. But I think there was also 1% where he was like, if you don't bring up Denzel one more time in this damn interview on this press tour.
Amazing.
Yeah,
okay, I'm going to check it out. I'll watch that, you watch Crazy
Yeah, we'll review. We'll do a swap review next week. Yeah, so a bit of exciting news if you're in the Philly area.
Woo-hoo.
So Tekish has been, you know,
in West Philadelphia.
So TechEdge is going to be at the North Star Black and Brown Founders Conference in Philly. It's going to be around October time. In the show notes, there'll be a link to how to book tickets for the conference. We'll be there emceeing. And not, I don't mean spitting bars. I mean, we're going to be there like hosting and stuff like that. And recording a few TechEdge related stuff. But yeah, so check it out. We'd love to see you there. And also just thank you to everybody that's been listening, because if it wasn't for you guys, we wouldn't have these kind of cool opportunities.
Yeah, if you haven't got your ticket yet, by the way, all our East Coast listeners, look, if you're in New York, Philly is not that far away, DC, wherever, maybe you're even in Philadelphia, check it out, Black and Brown Founders, North Zone, first weekend of October. Conference actually kicks off on Wednesday the 3rd. Michael and I will be there alongside an incredible amount of high-profile techies. There's going to be workshops on everything you need to know as an entrepreneur, fundraising, marketing, everything under the sun. So it'll be awesome to meet you in real life, but also for you to gain that content.
Thank you for listening, everybody. That's episode 22, I believe. And yeah, keep supporting, use the hashtag techish. Please review us on iTunes. It makes a massive difference, I'm not gonna lie. Hit us up at techishpod@gmail.com if you want any questions for us to answer on air. We love doing that. Also, we've got a Patreon now. We've got quite a few supporters on there, and we love you all as well. If you want to add to that, feel free. And yeah, we'll catch you next week. Anything you want to add, Abba?
Just share the link with a friend. Don't hesitate to share feedback on Twitter, because we'd love to hear from you.
Oh, well, thank you, Wendy. Cheers. Thank you. Bye.